The engine raced. Once. Twice. The bright new exhaust pipe shot blue smoke. Then the motor shut down. Will sat there, not moving. His door was shut, but there was an intercom always on between the office and the long barn-like garage area. It was the same intercom on which he had heard the beginnings of the Cunningham-Repperton title fight back in August. From the intercom speaker, he now heard the steady tick of metal as the engine cooled. He heard nothing else. No one got out of Christine, because there was no one in her to get out. He put stuff like that in an open file, because nothing really inexplicable had ever happened to him, except maybe something like that was happening now. He had seen her cross the cement to stall 20, the automatic door rattling shut against the cold December night behind her, and experts examining the case later could say the witness had dozed and then fallen asleep, he admits that much, and that he was dreaming. What he claims to have seen was obviously nothing more or less than an extension of that dream, an outward stimulus causing a subjective range of spontaneous dream-oriented imagery. Yes, they could say that, just as Will could dream of dancing with 15-year-old Wanda Haskins. But the reality was a hard-headed man of 61, a man who had long since jettisoned any last romantic notions. And he had seen Cunningham's 58 glide across the garage empty, the steering wheel moving all by itself as the car slipped into her accustomed stall. He had seen the headlights go off, and he had heard the 8-cylinder engine as it died. Now, feeling oddly boneless, Will Darnell got up, hesitated, went to the door of his office, hesitated again, and then opened it. He walked out and moved down the ranks of slant-parked cars to stall 20. His footfalls echoed behind him and then died out in a mystery. He stood beside the car with her rich two-tone body, red and white. The paint job was deep and clear and perfect, unmarred by the smallest chip or the slightest touch of rust. The glass was clear and unbroken, not marked by so much as a nick caused by a random flying pebble. The only sound now was the slow drip of melting snow from the front and rear bumpers. Will touched the hood. It was warm. He tried the driver's side door and it opened freely. The smell that issued forth was the warm smell of new leather, new plastic, new chrome. Except that there seemed to be another, more unpleasant smell beneath it. An earthy smell. Will breathed deep, but could not place it. He thought briefly of old turnips in his father's basement vegetable bin, and his nose wrinkled. He leaned in. There were no keys in the ignition. The odometer read 52,107.8. Suddenly, the empty ignition slot set into the dashboard revolved, the black slit healing over of its own accord past ACC to start. The hot engine caught at once and rumbled steadily, full of contented, high-octane power. Will's heart staggered in his chest, his breath caught. Gasping and whooping noisily for breath, he hurried back to his office to find the spare aspirator in one of his desk drawers. His breath, thin and impotent, sounded like winter wind under an entryway door. His face was the color of old candle wax. His fingers caught in the loose flesh of his throat and pulled restlessly. Christine's engine turned off again. No sound now, but the tick and click of cooling metal. Will found his aspirator, plunged it deep into his throat, depressed the trigger, and inhaled. Little by little, the feeling that a wheelbarrow full of cinder blocks was sitting on his chest dissipated. He sat down in the swivel chair and listened gratefully to the sane and expected creak of protest from its springs. He covered his face momentarily with his fat hands. Nothing really inexplicable. Until now. He had seen it. Nothing had been driving that car. It had come in empty, smelling of something like rotting turnips. And even then, in spite of his dread, Will's mind began to turn, and he began wondering how he could put what he knew to his own advantage. Chapter 38, Breaking Connections. The burned-out wreck of Buddy Repperton's Camaro was found late on Wednesday afternoon by a park ranger. An old lady who lived with her husband in the tiny town of Upper Squantic had called the ranger station on the lakeside of the park. She was badly afflicted with arthritis, and sometimes she couldn't sleep. Last night, she thought she had seen flames coming from near the park's south gate. At what time? She reckoned it to be around 10:15, because she had been watching the Tuesday night movie on CBS, and it hadn't been but half over. On Thursday, a news photo of the burned car appeared on the front page of the Libertyville Keystone, under a headline which read, "Three Killed in Car Crash at Squantic Hills State Park." A state police source was quoted as saying, "Liquor was probably a factor," an officially opaque way of saying that the shattered remains of over half a dozen bottles of a juice and wine combination sold under the trade name Texas Driver had been found in the wreckage. The news struck particularly hard at Libertyville High School. The young always have the greatest difficulty accepting unpleasant intelligence of their own mortality. Perhaps the holiday season made it that much harder. Arnie Cunningham found himself terribly depressed by the news. Depressed and frightened. First Moochie, now Buddy, Richie Trelawney, and Bobby Stanton. Bobby Stanton, a dipshit little freshman Arnie had never even heard of. What had a dipshit little kid like that been doing with the likes of Buddy Repperton and Richie Trelawney anyway? Didn't he know that was like going into a den of tigers with nothing for protection but a squirt gun? He found it unaccountably hard to accept the grapevine version, which was simply that Buddy and his friends had gotten pretty well squiffed at the basketball game, had gone out cruising and drinking, and had come to a bad end. He couldn't quite lose the feeling that he was somehow involved. Lee had stopped talking to him since the argument. Arnie didn't call her, partly out of pride, partly out of shame, partly out of a wish that she would call him first, and things could go back to what they had been before. Before what? His mind whispered. Well, before she almost choked to death in your car, for one thing. Before you tried to punch out the guy who saved her life. But she wanted him to sell Christine, and that was simply impossible, wasn't it? How could he do that after he had put so much time and effort and blood and, yes, it was true, even tears into it? It was an old rap, and he didn't want to think about it. The final bell rang on that seemingly endless Thursday, and he went out to the student parking lot, almost ran out, and nearly dived into Christine. He sat there behind the wheel and drew a long, shuddering breath, watching the first snowflakes of an afternoon flurry twist and skirl across the bright hood. He dug for his keys, pulled them out of his pocket, and started Christine up. The motor hummed confidently, and he pulled out, tires rolling and crunching over the packed snow. He would have to put snow tires on eventually, he supposed, but the truth was, Christine didn't seem to need them. She had the best traction of any car he had ever driven. He felt for the radio knob and turned on WDIL. Sheb Woolley was singing "The Purple People Eater." That raised a smile on his face at last. Just being behind Christine's wheel, in control, made everything seem better. It made everything seem manageable. Hearing about Repperton and Trelawney and the little shitter stepping out that way had been a terrible shock, naturally. And after the hard feelings of the late summer and this fall, it was probably natural enough for him to feel a little guilty. But the simple truth was, he had been in Philly. He hadn't had anything to do with it. It was impossible. He had just been feeling low about things in general. Dennis was in the hospital. Lee was behaving stupidly, as if his car had grown hands and jammed that piece of hamburger down her throat for Christ's sake. And he had quit the chess club today. Maybe the worst part of that had been the way Mr. Slauson, the faculty advisor, had accepted his decision without even trying to change his mind. Arnie had given him a lot of guff about how little time he had these days, and how he was simply going to have to cut back on some of his activities. And Mr. Slauson had simply nodded and said, "Okay, Arnie, we'll be right here in room 30 if you change your mind." Mr. Slauson had looked at him with his faded blue eyes that his thick glasses magnified to the size of repulsive boiled eggs, and there had been something in them. Was it reproach? Maybe it had been. But the guy hadn't even tried to persuade him to stay. That was the thing. He should have at least tried, because Arnie was the best the LHS Chess Club had to offer, and Slauson knew it. If he had tried, maybe Arnie would have changed his mind. The truth was, he did have a little more time now that Christine was... was... what? Well, fixed up again. If Mr. Slauson had said something like, "Hey, Arnie, don't be so rash. Let's think this over. We could really use you." If Mr. Slauson had said something like that, why, he might have reconsidered. But not Slauson. Just, "We'll be right here in room 30 if you change your mind," and blah, blah, and yak, yak. What a fucking shitter. Just like the rest of them. It wasn't his fault that LHS had been knocked out in the semifinal round. He had won 4 games before that, and would have won in the finals if he had gotten a chance. It was those two shitters, Barry Qualson and Mike Hicks, that had lost it for them. Both of them played chess as if maybe they thought Roy Lopez was some new kind of soft drink or something. He stripped the wrapper and the foil from a stick of gum, folded the gum into his mouth, balled the wrapper, and flicked it into the litter bag hanging from Christine's ashtray with neat accuracy. "Right up the little tramp's ass," he muttered. And then grinned. It was a hard, spitless grin. Above it, his eyes moved restlessly from side to side, looking mistrustfully out at a world full of crazy drivers and stupid pedestrians and general idiocy. Arnie cruised aimlessly around Libertyville, his thoughts continuing to run on in this softly paranoid and bitterly comforting fashion. The radio spilled out a steady flood of golden oldies, and today all of them seemed to be instrumentals. Rebel Rouser, Wild Weekend, Telstar, Sandy Nelson's jungle-driven teen beat, and Rumble by Link Ray, the greatest of them all. His back nagged, but in a low key. The flurry intensified briefly to a dark gray cloud of snow. He popped on his headlights, and just as quickly, the snow tapered off, and the clouds broke, spilling through bars of remote and coldly beautiful late-afternoon winter sun. He cruised. He came out of his thoughts, which now were that Repperton had maybe come to a perfectly fitting end after all, and was shocked to realize that it was nearly 6:15, and dark. Gino's Pizza was coming up on the left, the little green neon shamrocks shimmering in the dark. Arnie pulled over to the curb and got out. He started to cross the street, then realized he had left his keys in Christine's ignition. He leaned in to get them. And suddenly the smell assaulted him, the smell Lee had told him about, the smell he had denied. It was here now, as if it had come out when he left the car, a high, rotten, meaty smell that made his eyes water and his throat close. He snatched the keys and stood back, trembling, looking at Christine with something like horror. "Arnie, there was a smell, a horrible, rotten smell. You know what I'm talking about. No, I don't have the slightest idea. You're imagining things." But if she was... so was he. Arnie turned suddenly and ran across the street to Gino's as if the devil was on his tail. Inside, he ordered a pizza he didn't really want, changed some quarters for dimes, and slipped into the telephone booth beside the juke. It was thumping some current tune Arnie had never heard before. He called home first. His father answered, his voice oddly toneless. Arnie had never heard Michael's voice quite that way before, and his unease deepened. His father sounded like Mr. Slauson. This Thursday afternoon and evening were taking on the maroon tones of nightmare. Beyond the glass walls of the booth, strange faces drifted dreamily past, like untethered balloons on which someone had crudely drawn human faces, God at work with a magic marker. "Shitters," he thought disjointedly. "All a bunch of shitters." "Hello, Dad," he said uncertainly. "Look, I kind of lost track of the time here. I'm sorry." "That's all right," Michael said. His voice was almost a drone, and Arnie felt his unease deepen into something like fright. "Where are you? The garage?"
"No, Gino's. Gino's Pizza. Daddy, okay? You sound funny."
"I'm fine," Michael said. "Just scraped your dinner down the garbage disposal. Your mother's upstairs crying again, and you're having a pizza." "I'm fine." "Enjoying your car, Arnie?" Arnie's throat worked, but no sound came out.
"Dad," he managed finally, "I don't think that's very fair."
"I don't think I'm very interested anymore in what you think is fair and what you don't think is fair," Michael said. "You had some justification for your behavior at first, perhaps, but In the last month or so, you've turned into someone I don't understand at all, and something is going on that I understand even less. Your mother doesn't understand it either, but she senses it, and it's hurting her very badly. I know she brought part of the hurt on herself, but I doubt if that changes the quality of the pain.
Dad, I just lost track of the time, Arnie cried. Stop making such a big thing out of it.
Were you driving around?
Yes, but...
I notice that's when it usually happens, Michael said. Will you be home tonight?
Yes, early, Arnie said. He wet his lips. I just want to go by the garage. I have some information Will asked me to get while I was in Philly.
I'm not interested in that either. Pardon me, Michael said. His voice was still polite, chillingly disconnected. Oh, Arnie said in a very small voice. He was very scared now, almost trembling. Arnie?
What?
Arnie nearly whispered.
What is going on?
I don't know what you mean.
Please. That detective came by to see me at my office. He was after Regina as well. He upset her very badly. I don't think he meant to, but...
What was it this time? Arnie asked fiercely. That fucker! What was it this time? I'll...
You'll what?
Nothing.
He swallowed something that tasted like a lump of dust.
What was it this time?
Repperton, his father said. Repperton and those other two boys. What did you think it was? The geopolitical situation in Brazil?
What happened to Repperton was an accident, Arnie said. Why did he want to talk to you and Mom about something that was an accident, for Christ's sake?
I don't know.
Michael Cunningham paused.
Do you?
How would I? Arnie yelled. I was in Philadelphia. How would I know anything about it? I was playing chess, not anything else.
He finished lamely. One more time, Michael Cunningham said. Is something going on, Arnie? He thought of the smell, the high, rotting stink, Lee choking, digging at her throat, turning blue. He had tried to thump her on the back because that's what you did when someone was choking. There was no such thing as a Heimlich maneuver because it hadn't been invented yet. And besides, this was how it was supposed to end, only not in the car, beside the road, in his arms. He closed his eyes, and the whole world seemed to tilt and swirl, sickly.
Arnie?
There's nothing going on, he said through clenched teeth and without opening his eyes. Nothing but a lot of people who were on my case because I finally got something of my own and did it all by myself.
All right, his father said, his lackluster voice once more terribly reminiscent of Mr. Slauson's.
If you want to talk about it, I'm here. I always have been. Although I didn't always make that as clear as I should have. Be sure to kiss your mother when you come in, Arnie.
Yeah, I will. Listen, my...
Click. He stood in the booth, listening stupidly to the sound of nothing at all. His father was gone. There wasn't even a dial tone because it was a dumb, fucking phone booth. He dug into his pocket and spread his change out on a little metal shelf where he could look at it. He picked up a dime, almost dropped it, and at last got it into the slot. He felt sick and overheated. He felt as if he had been very efficiently disowned. He dialed Lee's number from memory. Mrs. Cabot picked the phone up and recognized his voice immediately. Her pleasant and rather sexy, come hither thou fascinating stranger phone voice became instantly hard. Arnie had had his last chance with her, that voice said, and he had blown it.
She doesn't want to talk to you, and she doesn't want to see you, she said. Mrs. Cabot, please, if I could just...
I think you've done enough, Mrs. Cabot said coolly. She came in crying the other night, and she's been crying off and on ever since. She had some sort of an experience with you the last time you and she went out, and I only pray it wasn't what I thought it was. Arnie felt hysterical laughter bubbling up inside him. Lee had almost choked to death on a hamburger, and her mother was afraid Arnie had tried to rape her.
Mrs. Cabot, I have to talk to her.
I'm afraid not.
He tried to think of something else to say, some way to get past the dragon at the gate. He felt a little like a Fuller Brush salesman trying to get in to see the lady of the house. His tongue wouldn't move. There was going to be that hard click and then smooth silence again. Then he heard the telephone change hands. Mrs. Cabot said something in sharp protest, and Lee said something back. It was too muffled for him to catch. Then Lee's voice said,
"Arnie?"
"Hi," he said. "Lee, I just wanted to call and tell you how sorry I was about..."
"Yes," Lee said. "I know you were, and I accept your apology, Arnie, but I won't... I can't go out with you anymore. Unless things change."
"Ask me something easy," he whispered.
"That's all I..."
Her voice sharpened, moved slightly away from the telephone.
"Mom, please stop hanging over me."
Her mother said something that sounded disgruntled. There was a pause, and then Lee's voice again, low.
"That's all I can say, Arnie. I know how crazy it sounds, but I still think your car tried to kill me the other night. I don't know how something like that could be, but no matter how I work it over in my mind, it comes out seeming that that was how it was. I know that's how it was. It's got you, doesn't it?"
"Lee, if you'll pardon my French...
That's pretty fucking stupid. It's a car.
Can you spell that? C-A-R, car? There's nothing..."
"Yes," she said, and now her voice was wavering toward tears. "It's got you. She's got you. And I guess nobody can get you free except... you."
His back suddenly awoke and began to throb, sending pain out in a sickish radiation that seemed to echo and amplify in his head.
"Isn't that the truth of it, Arnie?"
He didn't, couldn't answer.
"Get rid of it," Lee said. "Please. I read about that Repperton boy in the paper this morning, and..."
"What's that got to do with anything?" Arnie croaked, and for the second time, "That was an accident."
"I don't know what it was. Maybe I don't want to know, but... it isn't us I'm worried about anymore. It's you, Arnie. I'm scared for you. You ought to... no, you have to get rid of it."
Arnie whispered, "Just say you won't dump me, Lee, okay?" Now she was even closer to crying, or perhaps she was already doing it.
"Promise me, Arnie. You have to promise me, and then you have to do it. Then we can see. Promise me you'll get rid of that car. It's all I want from you. Nothing else."
He closed his eyes and saw Lee walking home from school, and a block down, idling at the curb, was Christine, waiting for her. He opened his eyes quickly, as if he had seen a fiend in a dark room. "I can't do that," he said.
"Then we don't have much to talk about, do we?"
"Yes, yes, we do. We..."
"No. Goodbye, Arnie. I'll see you in school."
"Lee, wait!" Click. And dead, smooth silence. A moment of nearly total rage came over him. He had a sudden deadly impulse to swing the black phone receiver around and around his head like an Argentinian bolas, shattering the glass in this goddamn torture chamber of a telephone booth. They had run out on him, all of them, rats deserting a sinking ship. "You have to be ready to help yourself before anyone else can help you." Fuck that bullshit. They were rats deserting a sinking ship. Not one of them, from that shitter Slauson with his thick horn-rimmed glasses and his weird poached egg eyes to his rotten shitting old man who was so fucking pussy-whipped that he ought to just give that cunt he was married to a razor and invite her to cut it off so that cheap bitch in her fancy house with her legs crossed, probably she'd been having her period, and that's why she choked on the goddamn hamburger, and those shitters with their fancy goddamn cars and the trunks full of golf clubs, those goddamn officers, I'd like to bend them over this here lathe. I'd play some golf with them. I could find the right hole to put those little white balls in, you bet your ass. But when I get out of here, no one's gonna tell me what to do. It's gonna be my way, my way, mine, 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 mine." Arnie came back to himself suddenly, scared and wide-eyed, breathing hard. What had happened to him? He had seemed like someone else there for a moment, someone on a crazed rant against humanity in general, not just someone.
It was LeBay.
No, that's not true at all. Lee's voice. Isn't that the truth of it, Arnie?
Suddenly something very like a vision rose in his tired, confused mind. He was hearing a minister's voice.
Arnold, do you take this woman to be your loving?
But it wasn't a church. It was a used car lot with bright, multicolored plastic pennants fluttering in a stiff breeze. Camp chairs had been set up. It was Will Darnell's lot, and Will was standing beside him in the best man's position. There was no girl beside him. Christine was parked beside him, shining in a spring sun, even her white walls seeming to glow. His father's voice,
is there something going on?
The preacher's voice,
who giveth this woman to this man?
Roland D. LeBay rose from one of the camp chairs like the prow of a skeletal ghost ship from Hades. He was grinning, and for the first time Arnie saw who had been sitting around him. Buddy Repperton, Richie Trelawney, Moochie Welch. Richie Trelawney was black and charred, most of his hair burned off. Blood had poured down Buddy Repperton's chin and had caked his shirt like hideous vomit. But Moochie Welch was the worst. Moochie Welch had been ripped open like a laundry bag. They were smiling. All of them were smiling.
I do, Roland D. LeBay croaked.
He grinned, and a tongue slimed with graveyard mold lolled from the stinking hole of his mouth.
I give her. And he's got the receipt to prove it. She's all his. The bitch is the ace of spades, and she's all his.
Arnie became aware that he was moaning in the telephone booth, clutching the receiver against his chest. With a tremendous effort, he pulled himself all the way out of the daze, vision, whatever it had been, and got hold of himself. This time, when he reached for the change on the ledge, he spilled half of it onto the floor. He plugged a dime into the slot and scrabbled through the telephone book until he found the hospital number. Dennis. Dennis would be there. Dennis always had been. Dennis wouldn't let him down. Dennis would help. The switchboard girl answered, and Arnie said,
Room 240, please?
The connection was made. The phone began to ring. It rang and rang and rang. Just as he was about to give up, a brisk female voice said,
Second floor, C-wing. Who are you trying to reach?
Gilder, Arnie said.
Dennis Gilder.
Mr. Gilder's in physical therapy right now, the female voice said. You could reach him at 8 o'clock. Arnie thought of telling her it was important, very important, but suddenly he was overwhelmed with a need to get out of the phone booth. Claustrophobia was like a giant's hand pushing down on his chest. He could smell his own sweat. The smell was sour, bitter.
Sir?
Yeah, okay, I'll call back, Arnie said.
He broke the connection and nearly burst out of the booth, leaving his change scattered on the ledge and the floor. A few people turned around to look at him, mildly interested, and then turned back to their food again.
Pizza's ready,
the counterman said. Arnie glanced up at the clock and saw he had been in the booth for almost 20 minutes. There was sweat all over his face. His armpits felt like a jungle. His legs were trembling. The muscles in his thighs felt as if they might simply give out and spill him onto the floor. He paid for the pizza, nearly dropping his wallet as he tucked his $3 in change back in.
You okay?
The counterman asked.
You look a little white around the gills.
I'm fine, Arnie said.
Now he felt as if he might vomit. He snatched the pizza in its white box with the word Geno's emblazoned across the top and fled into the cold, sharp clarity of the night. The last of the clouds had blown away, and the stars twinkled like chipped diamonds. He stood on the sidewalk for a moment, looking first at the stars and then at Christine, parked across the street, waiting, faithfully. She would never argue or complain, Arnie thought. She would never demand. You could enter her any time and rest on her plush upholstery, rest in her warmth. She would never deny. She loved him. Yes, he sensed that was true, just as he sometimes sensed that LeBay would not have sold her to anyone else, not for 250, not for 2,000. She had been sitting there waiting for the right buyer, one who would love her for herself alone, that voice inside whispered. Yes, that was it. That was exactly it.
Arnie stood there, with his pizza forgotten in his hands, white steam rising lazily from the grease-spotted box. He looked at Christine, and such a confusing whirl of emotions ran through him that there might have been a cyclone in his body, rearranging everything it did not simply destroy. Oh, he loved and loathed her. He hated her and cherished her. He needed her and needed to run from her. She was his and he was hers, and I now pronounce you man and wife, joined and sealed from this day forth forever and ever, until death do you part. But worst of all was the horror, the terrible, numbing horror, the realization that... How did you hurt your back that night, Arnie? After Repperton, the late Clarence, Buddy Repperton, and his buddies trashed her. How did you hurt your back so that now you have to wear this stinking brace all the time? How did you hurt your back? The answer rose, and Arnie began to run, trying to beat the realization to get to Christine before he saw the whole thing plain and went mad. He ran for Christine, running his tangled emotions and some terrible dawning realization a foot race. He ran to her the way a hype runs for his works when the shakes and the jitters get so bad he can no longer think of anything but relief. He ran the way that the damned run to their appointed doom. He ran as a bridegroom runs to the place where his bride stands waiting. He ran because inside Christine, none of these things mattered. Not his mother, father, Lee, Dennis, or what he had done to his back that night when everyone was gone. That night, after he had taken his almost totally destroyed Plymouth from the airport and back to Darnell's. And after the place was empty, he had put Christine's transmission in neutral and pushed her until she began to roll on her flat tires, pushed her until she was out the door and he could hear the wind of November keening sharply around the wrecks and the abandoned hulks with their stellated glass and their ruptured gas tanks. He had pushed her until the sweat ran off him in rivers and his heart thudded like a runaway horse in his chest, and his back cried out for mercy. He had pushed her, his body pumping as if in some hellish consummation. He had pushed her, and inside the odometer ran slowly backward, and some 50 feet beyond the door, his back began to really throb, and he kept pushing, and then his back began to scream in protest, and he kept pushing, muscling it along on the flat, slashed tires, his hands going numb, his back screaming, 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 and then... He reached Christine and flung himself inside, shuddering and panting. His pizza fell on the floor. He picked it up and set it on the seat, feeling calm, slowly wash through him like a soothing balm. He touched the steering wheel, let his hand slip down it, tracing its delicious curve. He took one glove off and felt in his pocket for his keys. For LeBay's keys. He could still remember what had happened that night, but it did not seem horrible now. Now, sitting behind Christine's steering wheel, it seemed rather wonderful. It had been a miracle. He remembered how it had suddenly become easier to push the car, because the tires were healing themselves magically, kneading themselves together without a scar, and then inflating. The broken glass had begun to reassemble from nowhere, knitting itself upward with small, scratchy, crystalline sounds. The dents began to pop back out. He simply pushed her until she was right enough to run. And then he had driven her, cruising between the rows until the odometer ran back past what Repperton and his friends had done. And then Christine was okay. What could be so horrible about that? Nothing, a voice said. He looked around. Roland D. LeBay was sitting on the passenger side of the car, wearing a black double-breasted suit, a white shirt, a blue tie. A row of medals hung askew on one lapel of his suit coat. It was the outfit he had been buried in. Arnie knew that even though he had never actually seen it. Only LeBay looked younger and tougher, a man you'd not want to fool with. "Start her up," LeBay said. "Get the heater going. And let's motivate."
"Sure,"
Arnie said, and turned the key. Christine pulled out,
tires crunching on the packed snow. He had pushed her that night until almost all the damage had been repaired. No, not repaired. Negated. Negated was the right word for what had happened. And then he had put her back in stall 20, leaving the rest to do himself.
"Let's have us some music," the voice beside him said.
Arnie turned on the radio. Dion was singing Donna the Prima Donna.
"You gonna eat that pizza or what?"
The voice seemed to be changing somehow.
"Sure," Arnie said. "You want a piece?"
Leering. "I never say no to a piece of anything."
Arnie opened the pizza box with one hand and pulled a piece free. "Here you go." His eyes widened. The slice of pizza began to tremble, the long threads of cheese dangling down beginning to sway like the strands of a spider web broken by the wind. It wasn't LeBay sitting there anymore. It was him. It was Arnie Cunningham, at roughly age 50, not as old as LeBay had been when he and Dennis first met him on that August day. Not that old, but getting there, friends and neighbors. Getting there. His older self was wearing a slightly yellowed t-shirt and dirty, oil-smeared blue jeans. The glasses were horn rims, taped at one bow. The hair was cut short and receding. The gray eyes were muddy and bloodshot. The mouth had taken all the tucks of sour loneliness, because this thing, apparition, whatever it was alone. He felt that. Alone. Except for Christine. This version of himself and Roland D. LeBay could have been son and father. The resemblance was that great.
"You gonna drive? Or are you gonna stare at me?"
this thing asked. And it suddenly began to age before Arnie's stunned eyes. The iron-colored hair went white, the t-shirt rippled and thinned, the body beneath twisted with age. The wrinkles raced across the face and then sank in like lines of acid. The eyes sank into their sockets, and the corneas yellowed. Now only the nose thrust forward, and it was the face of some ancient carrion-eater. But still his face, oh yes, still his.
"See anything green?"
this octogenarian Arnie Cunningham croaked as its body twisted and writhed and withered on Christine's red seat.
"See anything green? See anything green? See anything?"
The voice cracked and rose and whined into a shrill, senile treble, and now the skin broke open in sores and surface tumors, and behind the glasses milky cataracts covered both eyes like shades being pulled down. It was rotting before his very eyes, and the smell of it was what he had smelled in Christine before, what Lee had smelled, only it was worse now. It was the high, gassy, gagging smell of high-speed decay, the smell of his own death, and Arnie began to whine as little Richard came on the radio singing Tutti Frutti, and now the thing's hair was falling out in gossamer white drifts, and its collarbones poked through the shiny, stretched skin above the t-shirt's sagging round collar. They poked through like grotesque white pencils. Its lips were shriveling away from the final surviving teeth that leaned this way and that like tombstones. It was him. It was dead, and yet it lived. Like Christine, it lived.
"See anything green?" it gibbered. "See anything green?"
Arnie began to scream. Chapter 39. Junkins Again. Arnie pulled into Darnell's garage about an hour later. His rider, if there really had been a rider, was long gone. The smell was gone, too. It had undoubtedly just been an illusion. If you hung around the shitters for long enough, Arnie reasoned, everything started to smell like shit. And that made them happy, of course. Will was sitting behind his desk in his glassed-in office, eating a hoagie. He raised one drippy hand, but didn't come out. Arnie blipped his horn and parked. It had all been some kind of dream. Simple as that. Some crazy kind of dream. Calling home, calling Lee, trying to call Dennis and having that nurse tell him Dennis was in physical therapy. It was like being denied three times before the cock crew or something. He had freaked a little bit. Anyone would have freaked after the shit storm he's been through since August.
It was all a question of perspective, after all, wasn't it? All his life he had been one thing to people, and now he was coming out of his shell, turning into a normal everyday person with normal everyday concerns. It was not at all surprising that people should resent this, because when someone changed,
for better or worse, for richer or poorer,
it was natural for people to get a little weird about it. It fucked up their perspective. Lee had spoken as if she thought he was crazy, and that was nothing but bullshit of the purest ray serene. He had been under strain, of course he had, but strain was a natural part of life. If Miss High Box Oh-So-Preppy Lee Cabot thought otherwise, she was in for an abysmal fucking at the hands of that all-time champion rapist, Life. She'd probably end up taking Dexies to get out of first gear in the morning and Nembies or Ludes to come down at night. Ah, but he wanted her. Even now, thinking about her, he felt a great, unaccountable, unnameable desire sweep through him like cold wind, making him squeeze Christine's wheel fiercely in his hands. It was a hot wanting, too great, too elemental for naming. It was its own force. But he was all right now. He felt he had crossed the last bridge or something. He had come back to himself, sitting in the middle of a narrow access road beyond the farthest parking lot reaches of the Monroeville Mall, which meant he was roughly halfway to California. Getting out, looking behind the car, he had seen a hole smashed through a snowbank, and there was melting snow sprayed across Christine's hood. Apparently he had lost control, gone skating across the lot, which, even with the Christmas shopping season in full swing, was mercifully empty this far out, and had crashed through the bank. Damn lucky he hadn't been in an accident. Damn lucky. He had sat there for a while, listening to the radio and looking through the windshield at the half moon floating overhead. Bobby Helms had come on singing Jingle Bell Rock, a sound of the season, as the DJ said, and he had smiled a little, feeling better. He couldn't remember what exactly it was that he had seen, or thought he had seen, and he didn't really want to. Whatever it had been, it was the first and last time, he was quite sure of that. People had gotten him imagining things. They'd probably be delighted if they knew, but he wasn't going to give them that satisfaction. Things were going to be better all the way around. He would mend his fences at home. In fact, he could start tonight by watching some TV with his folks, just like in the old days. And he would win Lee back. If she didn't like the car, no matter how weird her reasons were, fine. Maybe he would even buy another car sometime soon and tell her he had traded Christine in. He could keep Christine here, rent space. What she didn't know wouldn't hurt her. And Will. This was going to be his last run for Will this coming weekend. That bullshit had gone just about far enough. He could feel it. Let Will think he was a chicken, if that's what he wanted to think. A felony rap for interstate transport of unlicensed cigarettes and alcohol wouldn't look all that hot on his college application, would it? A federal felony rap. No. Not too cool. He laughed a little. He did feel better. Purged. On his way over to the garage, he ate his pizza, even though it was cold. He was ravenous. It had struck him a bit peculiar that one piece was gone. In fact, it made him a bit uneasy. But he dismissed it. He had probably eaten it during that strange blank period, or maybe even thrown it out the window. Whew. That had been spooky. No more of that shit, and he laughed again, this time a little less shakily. Now he got out of the car, slammed the door, and started toward Will's office to find out what he had for him to do this evening. It suddenly occurred to him that tomorrow was the last day of school before the Christmas vacation, and that put an extra spring in his step. That was when the side door, the one beside the big carport door, opened, and a man let himself in. It was Junkins. Again. He saw Arnie looking at him and raised a hand. Hi, Arnie. Arnie glanced at Will. Through the glass, Will shrugged and went on eating his hoagie. Hello, Arnie said. What can I do for you? Well, I don't know, Junkins said. He smiled, and then his eyes slid past Arnie to Christine, appraising, looking for damage. Do you want to do something for me? Not fucking likely, Arnie said. He could feel his head starting to throb with rage again. Rudy Junkins smiled, apparently unoffended. I just dropped by. How you been? He stuck out his hand. Arnie only looked at it. Not embarrassed in the slightest, Junkins dropped his hand, walked around to Christine, and began examining her again.
Arnie watched him, his lips pressed together so tightly they were white. He felt a fresh pulse of anger each time Junkins dropped one of his hands onto Christine.
"Look, maybe you ought to buy a season ticket or something," Arnie said, "like to the Steelers games."
Junkins turned and looked at him questioningly.
"Never mind,"
Arnie said, sullenly. Junkins went on looking. "You know," he said, "it's a hell of a strange thing, what happened to Buddy Repperton and those other two boys, isn't it?"
"Fuck it," Arnie thought. "I'm not gonna fool around with this shitter. I was in Philadelphia, chest torny."
"I know," Junkins said.
"Jesus, you're really checking me out."
Junkins walked back to Arnie. There was no smile on his face now.
"Yes, that's right," he said. "I'm checking you out. Three of the boys I believe were involved in vandalizing your car are now dead, along with a fourth boy who was apparently just along for the ride on Tuesday night. That's a pretty big coincidence. It's 9 miles too big for me. You bet I'm checking you out."
Arnie stared at him, surprised out of his anger, uncertain.
"I thought it was an accident, that they were liquored up and speeding and..."
"There was another car involved," Junkins said.
"How do you know that?"
"There were tracks in the snow, for one thing. Unfortunately, the wind had blurred them too much for us to be able to get a decent photo. But one of the barriers at the Squanic Hill State Park gate was broken. We found traces of red paint on it. Buddy's Camaro wasn't red. It was blue." He measured Arnie with his eyes. "We also found traces of red paint embedded in Moochie Welch's skin, Arnie. Can you dig that? Embedded. Do you know how hard a car has to hit a guy to embed paint in his skin?"
"You ought to go out there and start counting red cars," Arnie said coldly. "He'll be up to 20 before you get to Basin Drive, I guarantee it."
"You bet," Junkins said.
"But we sent our samples to the FBI lab in Washington, where they have samples of every shade of paint they ever used in Detroit. We got the results back today. Any idea what they were? Want to guess?"
Arnie's heart was thudding dully in his chest. There was a corresponding beat at his temples.
"Since you're here, I'd guess it was autumn red. Christine's color."
"Give that man a Cupid doll,"
Junkins said. He lit a cigarette and looked at Arnie through the smoke. He had abandoned any pretense of good humor. His gaze was stony. Arnie clapped his hands to his head in an exaggerated gesture of exasperation.
"Autumn red, great. Christine's a custom job. But there were Fords from 1959 to 1963 painted autumn red, and Thunderbirds and Chevrolet offered that shade from 1962 to 1964. And for a while in the mid-50s, you could get a Rambler painted autumn red. I've been working on my 58 for half a year now. I get the car books. You can't do work on an old car without the books, or you're screwed before you start. Autumn red was a popular choice. I know it."
He looked at Junkins fixedly.
"And you know it, too. Don't you?"
Junkins said nothing. He only went on looking at Arnie in that fixed, stony, unsettling way. Arnie had never been looked at in that way by anyone in his life. But he recognized the gaze. He supposed anyone would. It was a look of strong, frank suspicion. It scared him. A few months ago, even a few weeks ago, that was probably all it would have done. But now, it made him furious as well.
"You're really reaching. Just what the hell have you got against me anyway, Mr. Junkins? Why are you on my ass?"
Junkins laughed and walked around in a large half-circle. The place was entirely empty except for the two of them out here and Will in his office, finishing his hoagie and licking olive oil off his hands and still watching them closely.
"What have I got against you?" he said.
"That is first-degree murder sound to you, Arnie. Does that grab you with any force?" Arnie grew very still.
"Don't worry," Junkins said, still walking. "No big, tough cop scene. No menacing threats about going downtown. Except in this case, downtown would be Harrisburg. No Miranda card. Everything is still fine for our hero, Arnold Cunningham."
"I don't understand any of what you're... You? understand?
Plenty!
Junkins roared at him. He had stopped next to a giant yellow hulk of a truck, another of Johnny Pomberton's dumpsters in the making. He stared at Arnie.
Three of the kids who beat on your car are dead. Autumn red paint samples were taken at both crime scenes, leading us to believe that the vehicle the perpetrator used in both cases was at least in part autumn red. And gee whiz, it just turns out that the car those kids trashed is mostly autumn red. And you stand there, and you push your glasses up on your nose, and you tell me you don't understand what I'm talking about?
I was in Philadelphia when it happened, Arnie said, quietly. Don't you get that? Don't you get that at all?
Kiddo, Junkins said, flipping his cigarette away. That's the worst part of it. That's the part that really stinks.
I wish you'd get out of here or put me under arrest or something, because I'm supposed to punch in and do some work.
For now, Junkins said, talk is all I got. The first time, when Welch got killed, you were supposed to be home in bed.
Pretty thin, I know, Arnie said. Believe me, if I'd known this shit was gonna come down on my head, I would have hired a sick friend to sit up with me.
I don't know, that was good, Junkins said. Your mother and father had no cause to doubt your tale. I could tell that from speaking to them. And alibis, the true ones, usually have more holes than a Salvation Army suit. It's when they start to look like suits of armor that I get nervous.
Holy jumping Jesus! Arnie almost screamed. It was a fucking chess meet! I've been in the chess club for 4 years now!
Until today, Junkins said, and Arnie grew still again. Junkins nodded. Oh, yeah. I talked to the club advisor, Herbert Slauson. He says that the first 3 years you never missed a meeting, even came to a couple with a low-grade case of the flu. You were his star player. Then this year, you were spotty right from the start.
I had my car to work on, and I got a girl.
He said you missed the first 3 tourneys, and he was pretty surprised when your name turned up on the trip sheet for the Northern States meet. He thought you'd lost all your interest in the club.
I told you.
Yes, you did. Too busy. Cars and girls. Just what makes most kids too busy. But you regained your interest long enough to go to Philly, and then you dropped out. That strikes me as very odd.
I can't see anything funny about it,
Arnie said, but his voice seemed distant, almost lost in the surf roar of blood in his ears.
Bullshit. It looks as if you knew it was coming down and set yourself up with an airtight alibi.
The roar in his head had even assumed the steady, wave-like beats of surf, each beat accompanied by a dull thrust of pain. He was getting a headache. Why wouldn't this monstrous man with his prying brown eyes just go away? None of it was true. None of it. He hadn't set anything up. Not an alibi. Not anything. He had been as surprised as anyone else when he read in the paper what had happened. Of course he had been. There was nothing strange going on, unless it was this lunatic's paranoia, and...
How did you hurt your back, anyway, Arnie? And by the way, do you see anything green? Do you see?
He closed his eyes, and for a moment the world seemed to lurch out of its orbit, and he saw that green, grinning, rotting face floating before him, saying,
start her up. Get the heater going and let's motivate. And while we're at it, let's get the shitters that wrecked our car. Let's grease the little cocksuckers, kid. What do you say? Let's hit them so fucking hard the corpse cutter down at the city hospital will have to pull the paint chips out of their carcasses with pliers. What do you say? Find some doo-wop music on the radio and let's cruise. Let's...
He groped back behind him, touched Christine, her hard, cool, reassuring surface, and things dropped back into place again. He opened his eyes. There's only one other thing, really, Junkins said, and it's very subjective. Nothing you could put on a report. You're different this time, Arnie. Harder, somehow. It's almost as if you put on 20 years. Arnie laughed, and was relieved to hear it sounded quite natural.
Mr. Junkins, you've got a screw loose.
Junkins didn't join him in his laughter. Uh-huh. I know it. The whole thing is screwy.
Screwier than anything I've investigated in the 10 years I've been a detective. Last time, I felt like I could reach you, Arnie. I felt you were, I don't know, lost, unhappy, groping around, trying to get out. Now I don't feel that at all. I almost feel like I'm talking to a different person. Not a very nice one.
I'm done talking to you, Arnie said abruptly, and began walking toward the office.
I want to know what happened, Junkins called after him. And I'm gonna find out. Believe me.
Do me a favor and stay away from here, Arnie said. You're crazy.
He let himself into the office, closed the door behind him, and noticed his hands weren't shaking at all. The room was stuffy with the smells of cigar and olive oil and garlic. He crossed in front of Will without speaking, took his time card out of the rack, and punched in. Kthud. Then he looked through the glass window and saw Junkins standing there, looking at Christine. Will said nothing. Arnie could hear the noisy engine of the big man's respiration. A couple of minutes later, Junkins left.
Cop, Will said, and ripped out a long belch. It sounded like a chainsaw. Yeah. Repperton? Yeah. He thinks I had something to do with it. Even though you were in Philly?
Arnie shook his head.
He doesn't even seem to care about that. He's a smart cop, then, Will thought. He knows the facts are wrong, and his intuition tells him there's something even wronger than that. So he's gotten further with it than most cops ever would. But he could spend 1,000,000 years and not get all the way to the truth.
He thought of the empty car, driving itself into stall 20 like some weird wind-up toy. The empty ignition slot turning over to start. The engine revving once, like a warning snarl, and then falling off. And thinking of these things, Will did not trust himself to look Arnie in the face, even though his own experience in routine deceit was nearly lifelong.
I don't want to send you to Albany if the cops are watching you. I don't care if you send me to Albany or not, but you don't have to worry about the heat. He's the only cop I've seen, and he's crazy. He's not interested in anything but 2 cases of hit and run.
Now Will's eyes did meet Arnie's. Arnie's gray and distant, Will's a faded no color, the cornea's a dim yellow. They were the eyes of an ancient tomcat who has seen 1,000 mice turned inside out.
He's interested in you, he said. I'd better send Jimmy. You like the way Jimmy drives, do you?
Will looked at Arnie for a moment and then sighed.
Okay, he said. But if you see that cop, you back off. And if you get caught holding a bag, Cunningham, it's your bag. Do you understand that?
Yes, Arnie said. Do you want me to do some work tonight or what?
There's a 77 Buick in 49. Pull the starter motor, check the solenoid. If it seems okay, pull that too.
Arnie nodded and left. Will's thoughtful eyes drifted from his retreating back to Christine. He had no business sending him to Albany this weekend, and he knew it. The kid knew it, too. But he was going to push ahead anyway. He had said he'd go. And he was now going to, by God, do it. And if anything happened, the kid would stand up. Will was sure of it. There was a time when he surely wouldn't have done. But that time was past now. He had heard it all on the intercom. Junkins had been right. The kid was harder now. Will began to look at the kid's 58 again. Arnie would be taking Will's Chrysler to New York. While he was gone, Will would watch Christine. He would watch Christine and see what happened. Chapter 40. Arnie in Trouble. Rudolph Junkins and Rick Mercer of the Pennsylvania State Police Detective Division sat drinking coffee the following afternoon in a glum little office with paint peeling from the walls. Outside, a depressing mixture of snow and sleet was falling.
I'm pretty sure this is going to be the weekend, Junkins said. That Chrysler has rolled every 4 or 5 weeks for the last 8 months.
Just understand that busting Darnell and whatever bee you've got in your bonnet about that kid are two different things.
They're both the same thing to me, Junkins replied. The kid knows something. If I get him rattled, I may find out what it is.
You think he had an accomplice? Someone who used his car and killed those kids while he was at the chess tourney?
Junkins shook his head.
No, goddammit. The kid has got exactly one good friend, and he's in the hospital. I don't know what I think, except that the car was involved, and he was involved, too.
Junkins put his styrofoam coffee cup down and pointed at the man on the other side of the desk.
Once we get that place closed down, I want a six-pack of lab technicians to go over it from stem to stern, inside and out. I want it up on a lift. I want it checked for dents, bumps, repaint, and for blood. That's a